So pleased to be with you. Very grateful to Bishop Linda for doing yesterday. As you gather, I chair the Church of England's national panel that seeks to discern whether people who offer themselves for ordained pioneer ministry actually do have the character, capacity and calling to be pioneers, because those who think they are aren't necessarily the ones who can. And we had 10 candidates, 8 yeses and not yet, and most certainly not yet. And so it was a good day's work, but it did mean I couldn't get here any earlier than I did. We're meant to be talking about leading denominational structures in disciple making. Now, I'm trying desperately to stand somewhere where I'm not blocking the screen. If you'll excuse me, I will, so that there's something on the tape, for about 20 minutes go through some proposals and suggestions and issues, and then we'll just get a really good conversation going, if that's all right. We're all senior leaders together, and I've done one long lecture this morning already. So some of this is by pictures. You know those occasions when they stick up some pictures and ask what you think the people might have in common. We'll beard certainly, yes, but before we'll come back to the answer of that one. Let me just make a point or two about our personal ministries of leaders of whole wider communities of the church that we seek to be discipling communities. I find it very easy to be a professional Christian leader and have to guard carefully my desire to have an appetite to grow deeper into God. And if you don't attend to yourself, you don't attend to all the other stuff. The jobs you're doing, you all know it, but I have a Greek evangelist friend who likes to say, "I know that you know, but I just thought I'd remind you." If there's nothing in there, then there's nothing to give, however competent we are in the executive responsibilities we have. I want to say that having the jobs we do doesn't get us out of the challenge I made about personal investment in individuals. It's not favoritism. In fact, for many of us, identifying the vocations of future leaders of God's church or investing in a life at a vital moment that put back on track can make a significant difference, maybe one of the most significant things we do. And therefore, there's something about diaries and something about willingness to invest in a person over a period of time and not let the diaries just be filled with everybody that our PAs put in who desperately needs to see us. And there's something in there about prioritizing, but I think it's more about discernment and making disciples as Jesus made disciples. There's actually something very important pastoral. Discipleship is not separate from pastoral care. When I was training to be ordained, my friend in the room next door had a personal tragedy, and he phoned his bishop, a man called Graham Leonard, who was then Bishop of Willesden, and he said, "Bishop, I need to come and see you." And Bishop Graham said, "There's not really a space in my diary for 3 weeks. My father just died. Come now." And I think that capacity is essential. That I think trust with clergy is earned at moments like that. It's not why you do it, but it's why they know they can trust you. If I can tell I do tend to tell rather a lot of Rowan stories. I've had nearly 10 years of working with him on this stuff and love him deeply. And in the Diocese of Canterbury, we had a difficult parish, multi-estates. An able woman priest had to take early retirement through breast cancer. She survived, but she couldn't continue stipendiary ministry. for 20 months, we couldn't find anybody willing to go there. It was tough. And this priest from a rural context at that time came forward, was appointed, did a quite superb job. And 18 months later was identified with terminal cancer. The parish had a double whammy. So my colleague, the Bishop of Dover, changed his diary, and the immediate Sunday he took the services. I changed my diary, and the next Sunday I took the services. And I told them, and we've got next week sorted out, your services next week will be taken by the Archbishop of Canterbury. Rowan arrives, deliberately doesn't bring any robes, says, what does your priest normally wear? Great, give me those. Takes the service beautifully and goes to lunch at the vicarage. The priest is more in shock than at that time physically. No, not because the archbishop was there, but because of the cancer, you know. And died in a way over the next 18 months that said more of Jesus than all of his life, too. But Rowan is having a meal in the vicarage, and there's a knock on the door. Church warden appears. Vicar, we're so sorry, but the retired priest we got to do the baptism hasn't turned up, and the family's here. So Clive starts to get up, and Rowan says, don't you move, won't be a moment. Goes across, doesn't say who he is, takes the baptism, comes back, grins at them and says, they hadn't the faintest idea who I was. That was really good. And somebody someday might look at a signature on a baptism certificate. But that story went round the diocese. This man may have a brain a mile wide. This man may have views we do or don't disagree with. This man may this, this may that. But this is a pastor. And I think it's as a pastor you earn the right to be a disciple maker. So please don't become a professional CEO. You're an overseer in the Church of God, whatever your denomination, whatever your particular role. Be professional in it, because that's the way you serve your people. But our core vocation is leadership in mission. One of the changes in the Church of England in recent years, happening entirely parallel with the Fresh Expression stuff, was a revision of our ordination rites to bring leadership in mission to the fore in all three orders. And whether you are in Anglican terms a bishop or a member of a bishop's diocesan team, or whether in your own denomination you exercise oversight at whatever level, it's to lead the people of God in the mission of God that above all you were called. I do have a few archbishop pictures. Let's have that one again. Was on my parish church forecourt of a previous job. So we model the making of disciples in personal and public ministry. Mission-shaped church bishops have a key role in setting mission priorities, in releasing resources for mission, and in their powers to ordain and license. And forgive me, some of my slides are inevitably Anglican, so please just translate, can you? Uniting Church, the Baptists, and so on. We're all in the same learning in weakness, new things together. I just speak from where I come from. And this includes, we said, the ability to send fresh apostolic teams to cultures or areas where the mission presence is thin or non-existent. Told you about Damien and the supermarket celebration. The conversation in the Bishop of Blackburn staff meeting actually went something like this. Let's send Damien in and see who sticks to him. But, you know, a one-man apostolic team got sent in, and through patience and courage, people stuck to him. But let's just be careful. Because we are the key holders to the release of people and resources and priorities and things like that, let's remember it is leadership in the mission of God that we're talking about. You know, there's a tradition in some places of having a boy bishop for a day. It's to remind you that you're not really in charge. And that mission doesn't begin with us, it begins with God. So all initiatives don't have to come from us. I don't think Christian leadership has much at all to do with control. It has quite a lot to do with appropriate godly discipline, but it's about discernment, not control. Therefore, if we didn't think of it, doesn't mean it's a bad idea. Very often, our capacity to identify that what someone has seen or half seen is really important and to stand with it is vital. But we are discerning what God is doing and joining in just as much as someone in a parish or in a neighborhood trying to work out how to do a fresh expression. And we need the capacity to recognize God's initiatives. I think at every level of this ministry, informed discernment is the critical capacity. What's God doing here? What's the right thing to do? Which, of course, is rooted in prayer. I love John V. Taylor's book, The Go-Between God, in which he says, mission is often described as if it were a planned extension of an old building. In fact, it's usually been more like an unexpected explosion. I mean, even with us, if you had told the group of us who wrote Mission Shaped Church that, you know, 8 years on or whatever it is, you know, various of us would be going to various parts of the world, we would have at least 1,000 fresh expressions in the Church of England, another 1,000 in the Methodist Church, etc., 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 we'd have said, well, it would be nice. And, you know, God looks for the least likely and says, watch here, I think. Public ministry, well, we are, most of us in our roles anyway, are called to teach and disciple the church. That's a Canterbury's link with Madagascar, so that's where, that's about the north of Madagascar. But nearly all of us have to give more talks than we'd like. Nearly all of us have to do them on what are people's special occasions. And therefore, nearly all of us have a very significant vision and priority showing in our teaching ministry. Whatever our particular theology, whatever our particular role, whatever our particular understanding of the kingdom. But my emphasis on context, I want to apply here as well. If we're stewards, we are, by being overseas, we're stewards of the way in which the gospel might take local shape, but is clearly still the gospel. There's something about what are the issues in this city? What are the issues in this diocese? What are the issues in this particular Baptist association? What are the issues in this district or whatever it's called of the Uniting Church? Forgive me, I reveal my ignorance. And are there some characteristic things here which, if the gospel does not address, it is not the gospel at all? We may not be the people who are the first to see it, but we may be the first people to articulate it so it is significantly heard. And what particular idolatries or opportunities are here that are part of how the gospel takes shape and that makes it a little bit easier for the local questions to be answered? This is the famous moment where Sentamu on BBC TV, in his stance against, actually not the local, but Robert Mugabe's tyranny in Zimbabwe, cut his dog collar up on public television and said he would not wear another one till he's gone. And is still not wearing one. But there is something about the slightly larger area that we oversee and our capacity to read a bigger picture than the very local that might help identify. But most of what we do as disciple makers is enable the ministry of others. It goes in the nature of the sort of more senior jobs we do. As I look at what's happened in the Church of England, three factors, what basically I believe by God's grace we called a wave of the Holy Spirit, but when you look at what the Holy Spirit did, three things. One is that ordinary, everyday Anglican Christians and Methodist Christians are beginning to imagine the possibility of mission and church in ways they wouldn't have imagined, say, even 10 years ago. Sometimes it's elderly worshippers out of deep concern that none of their grandchildren go to church. Sometimes it can be all sorts of things. But if this was not a grassroots movement, if there was not something that the Spirit of God was doing in the local, then I wouldn't call it a movement of God. So it largely hasn't come from us. Even the report we wrote was telling stories of over about 20 years and why they might be important. But there's also a new climate of permission. Does the Anglican Church have church wardens or that sort of title? Okay, well, certainly in our bad old days when the same person could be a church warden for 25 years, you know, there's a true story where a bishop of Pontefract put in a new vicar in Huddersfield and met the church warden who had been there since Noah. And said to him, "And I bet you've seen some changes in this time." And he really did reply, "And yes, and I have resisted every single one of them." That was also the service with the most wonderful misprint. One of the hymns wasn't "Down as Our God Reigns," but "Our God Resigns." And in that particular parish, you could understand why. But the last default resist the new priest with changes stance of the church warden always used to be the bishop would never allow it. Now, in my context, I think just about irrespective of theology or churchmanship, just about all of my colleagues would say, "I would be profoundly disappointed if you didn't try." And just now, that ranges from, "Okay, but don't ask me," to thoroughgoing support. I don't think "okay, but don't ask me" has Christian credibility. As a vicar in York, I remember saying to our bishop, who was deeply supportive, our area bishop, "We're thinking of doing so-and-so." And he said, "That sounds really good. You know, excellent, Graham. Please don't ask me." You know, because he felt at that stage he couldn't say yes. But and I remember thinking then, if anybody ever makes me a bishop, being utterly convinced there was never any possibility that that would happen, I'm not going to do that. If it's right, I'm going to say, and I'll stand with you. And if it falls, then we'll learn together what we can learn from it. Because the other thing, of course, that would happen, even with the nicest people, was that which you didn't ask them about then goes well. And you hear them saying to a fellow bishop, "Well, in our diocese, we..." So there's something about ungrudging permission that carries with it support. You are not alone in this, because there's something very lonely about doing something new. And then the third bit of the ecology is Archbishop Rowan brought team into being, which has produced the training resources which you've turned into your own and so on. So you could imagine it. You genuinely were allowed and encouraged to try, and someone could show you how. And it's not rocket science once that's in place, but it's overseers who have the opportunity to make sure that that sort of ecology is in place. So enabling the ministry of others. Do you use the term cure of souls? Okay, here's Chris, Bishop of Coventry, just licensed a new priest. And he is saying, and means to the best of his ability, A, you bear the spiritual responsibility before God pastorally for all the people who live in this community, not just those who come to church. And that's the profoundly Anglican reason for Fresh Expressions. We are not chaplains to congregations. We are priests to communities. And if vast majorities of the community don't come to our church or anybody else's and seem to have no connection to Christ, then there's something before God to try and sort out. But it really is saying you're not alone in this either. You carry it for me here. You will have to do the great deal, but you do not stand alone. You have my prayers. You have my support. I'm there when you need me. Encourager. So there's Humphrey, the first ever confirmation in the messy church he'd just done. And there's Rowan. And Rowan is with an ordained pioneer minister, and Rowan is launching the Order of the Black Sheep. And the guy on his right used to play bass in a heavy metal band. He's ordained in the Church of England, he's done the pioneer curacy, and he has now created literally this community for goths, heavy metalers, people on the edge who are finding a place and finding a faith. And I have another dodgy YouTube video, not of quality to be shown anywhere, and professionally, of Rowan sitting on a beanbag in the middle of this very interesting bunch of people saying, do you know the great thing about Jesus? He was totally unfussed about who people were. If he was with you, he thought you were worth his full attention. And that's what this place is about. And that sort of affirmation, the person who looks least like someone, the Archbishop of Canterbury, should be supporting. Rowan loved it, really understood the ministry. But we also, most of us, our greatest influence is who we appoint. It's vacancies in parishes. It's our role in appointments of ministers, whatever the polity may be. It's the recognition of those with a call to be ordained or to a key lay ministry. It's who we ordain, who we license, and so on, is critical. And I think is the part of our ministry that needs to be exercised most prayerfully and carefully, which is why, it's not that I'm embarrassed, but not too embarrassed enough to say, but I'm sorry, but not sorry, I wasn't here earlier, because I had a key part to play in the Church of England's discernment about the 10 potential future ministers. But I think we need to identify, train, ordain, and deploy those with the capacity to grow the church. Now, I don't mean evangelism instead of social action. I mean mission as the full five marks. I mean holistic, integral. Please just hear me about that. But what has happened, I think, is that in the Christendom years, there was a certain gift mix. I used that term in Germany recently, and they howled in laughter because gift is German for poison. But if you use the language of Ephesians 5, it was pastors and teachers. And these prophetic, apostolic, even evangelistic sort of people weren't quite Anglican or weren't quite traditional church. Now we need them, but we need them not as mavericks, but deeply ingrained. We need combinations we haven't seen before, like, say, prophet-pastor. The capacity to care for people and not just, speak into the situation. And so, and many of us have a say, therefore, about the qualities and criteria that we're looking for in those we call. And I think we owe it not to call and ordain the wrong people. The clergy who worried me most as Bishop of Maidstone were faithful, godly people who had been trained in what you might, for shorthand, call the old model, had exercised it faithfully for 20 years or more, had seen their congregation steadily decline, and the last thing they needed was a sparky new bishop with a new vision, because it was another thing to make them feel guilty, another thing to fail at. And we should not be calling those who don't have the tools for the task that we now face. That's not to say there's a stereotype. That's not to say that we don't need good pastoral people. That's not to say we don't have teachers in the church. But where we have a say in vocations or in the drawing up of criteria, let's address the mission calling now and not hope that we can adapt. With our pioneer criteria, all of the Church of England's national selection criteria are seeking potential, because we recommend to train rather than guarantee to ordain at that point. For pioneer, four of the criteria have the word demonstrable. We are, for instance, convinced that not everybody has the gift to create something out of nothing. And if you haven't got it, we don't think we can train it into you. And therefore, we ask for a demonstrable track record of innovation. We ask for a portfolio of evidence. And if someone comes and offers and understands all the theory, but wherever they have been has never started anything, we question whether actually they have that capacity. So I think we have some responsibilities in that area. Bishops as brokers, not in the financial markets, please. And the mission-shaped church and any proposed mission where new churches beyond parish boundaries or crossing them are in view, it's right and necessary the bishop or the superintendent or whatever it is act as broker in discussions. We can, if people trust our office, whatever it is, and if people trust us and the way we minister in that office and are not scared to come and see us, well, unless they don't know us properly, then we can handle quite a lot of the negotiations. We can make possible something that would not have been possible before. And as we do it, are making clear that if this proposal takes place, we support it. We've had to change canon law on this one. For bishops' mission orders, we had no legal base for, say, a network congregation the diocese recognised across several parishes or something like that. So, and the principle in the canon is right. You don't do something in someone else's parish without the permission of the priest or the blessing of the priest. But there were some exceptions. The army can stick down a base and have a chaplain without the vicar saying yes or no. So we could keep the principle of putting another exception unless the bishop of the diocese has established a mission order. Because we had a number of stories where really appropriate work needed to be done. There was a case in Sheffield, very similar to the one I described in Manchester, where what was warehouses and offices was now residential flats for young adults. And a very traditional Anglo-Catholic congregation that was not in communion with its bishop because its bishop ordained women, that simply did not have the capacity to engage with this new invasion of entirely different people into its parish, but very clearly did not have the will. It was absolutely clear that there was a way to do church, and if those young people didn't know it, shame on them. But when the bishop negotiated with a parish that worked with students, from which a curate could come with a team, the answer was, "Bishop, if you try that, I'll take you to the church court." And would have won absolutely, because it was without the consent of the parish priest. So we have changed the law that says the parish priest will be consulted, but in something like this, the bishop, after consultation, will make a judgment. And that's been necessary. The fact that we I'm nearly done. The fact that we do all this stuff in the context of what we call mixed economy is easier because we're not asking people on the whole to give up the traditional worship they love. We're just asking them not to forbid someone else to do something that will engage the faith with another group of people that somehow are not being connected to the worship that they love. And there's a couple of little quotes about living with variety and so on. Diplomat, second and last Rowan Williams story. Rowan said to me one day, "One minister in the Diocese of Monmouth, before I came to Canterbury, caused me more trouble than all the rest put together. He had remarkable skills to reach those totally untouched by the rest of the diocese, and absolutely no diplomatic skills whatsoever to relate to the rest of the clergy." That's Sean on the right. This is called Zach's Place. I'll play you the video tomorrow morning, and it's Rowan Williams' favourite fresh expression of church. And certainly, I don't know, now he's stood down, I don't know whether it's gone, but if you used to go on the Zach's Place website, and the first thing that came up was a commendation for the Most Reverend and Right Honourable Rowan Williams, Archbishop of Canterbury. And Rowan said, "I was continually acting as a diplomat for him, explaining him to people, explaining others to him." And they said two things. "I never once regretted the appointment, and I learned more about what it meant to be a bishop standing alongside him than anything else I did in that diocese." So it's just something. the some of the people we most need are unskilled in explaining themselves to those who see things different. And our job, if we have a real commitment ourselves to mixed economy, is to do some of that. Which just leads to saying, I think we have to learn to live with disagreement while remaining united in the task of mission and evangelism. That it seems to me the mission of the church is more important than what side you take on sexuality debates, ordination debates, all sorts of other things, doctrines of the atonement. I'm a floorboard evangelical with nearly all the beliefs that you expect would come with a floorboard evangelical, but I'm a bishop of the Church of God, and I believe the whole Church of the God is called to mission and ministry. There's something about keeping people engaged in a common focus of mission, even if when they come together in synod, they're profoundly divided over an issue. I think if we, however important these issues are, however iconic some of them are for our age, if they consume all our energy and completely break our relationships, just, the devil in whom I do believe has won a victory. Which means we're called to be peacemakers. Do you know, Pinchas Lapid puts this rather lovely rabbinical parable, the lowly cooking pot without any fanfare performs a daily miracle as its thin bottom separates two inimical elements of fire and water from one another. It doesn't reconcile the two of them, but succeeds in inducing them to peaceful and constructive collaboration, a culinary collaboration from which flows good in form of tasty blessings. You've got to be a bit like a saucepan or a cooking pot if you're going to be a peacemaker. And I think overseers in the Church of God are called to be peacemakers and seek what is good in collaboration can come, even when there is not reconciliation. I think it's living with that incompleteness that's vital. Rowan at Lambeth, leadership is not about giving commands nor even about making decisions. It's quite literally about leading, clearing the way, making it possible for us to go where otherwise we could not. That's my last quote, two pictures to come, but my last quote, because I find that profoundly helpful. What can I do that we can go where we need to go? How can I lead so that we can participate in the mission of God as best I discern it? And how can I facilitate a direction that would not otherwise be possible? Culture changes so fast that we're all managers of change, whether we want to or not. That relates totally. Just two pictures and then we're into conversation together. A health warning about Christian leadership. Do look at that fairly carefully. It just might be that you have to be willing to take a risk. It's a time for wisdom as Christian leaders. I'm not at all convinced it's a time for caution. And I am the missioner for both archbishops, so we'll end with one dropping from the sky. Okay, just for the sake of recording, how we help faithful clergy who have faithfully done what they've been taught and see their congregations consistently decline. Yes, absolutely. Our experience from Canterbury is that some you can help and some you can't. That some we can do some training and support with them that helps them imagine differently. That some we're simply going to have to wait till they go or retire. And one or two we need to help retire early. I'm afraid we did some, this is not the proper answer to the question, I'm afraid we did some financial sums about parish share, and we saw the parish's contribution going down and down, and we did a sum against buying about 3 extra years of pension against, and it was worth, and actually The one or two people we did that with were profoundly grateful because they were worn out and they were only continuing because they couldn't afford to stop. And so that can be pastoral. We began, I think we had to introduce into the diocese a culture of ongoing learning that a lot of those clergy found quite difficult. They came from a time when you were trained, you started, and you were fully made, and had a director of ministry who was able to create courses that all incumbents went on at the right time, which rooted spirituality with some new skills, so Benedictine spirituality and all sorts of new skills, basically, and put them in small groups. Well, we took them away to a monastery in Belgium for about 5 days, did a first stage, brought them back, put them in small groups where each of them was going to attempt one new thing they'd identified as appropriate, and they would support one another, meeting once a month, and then 6 months later, a second session. That, over 4 or 5 years, has sort of significantly changed the balance. There's also a very good course in England that all churchmanships go to, called Leading Your Church into Growth. And there were some clergy who simply didn't know what to do, but there actually were things they could do that wouldn't be objectionable to their churchmanship or their spirituality. Just nobody had taught them, because who taught this stuff at theological college 30 years ago? That's the problem. But the reality was, there are some, you pray that the parish is going to be okay, but it's not going to change till they go. And you, but actually, we don't have the resources if they all wanted to change at the same time either, is also true. Please. Yeah.
What are the elements of character and pastoral
core competencies in a pioneer? Was the demonstrable ones are. I mean, the obvious one, which is that the gifting there is there a demonstrable history of, let's call it, innovation? It's not that they must have planted fresh expressions of church. Another criterion will make sure they deeply understand the nature of fresh expressions. They're deeply committed to the whole mixed economy, and they have a realistic understanding of the ministry. But that can all be theory. So the evidence that, frankly, they start things as part of their Christian vocation. We can then teach them to start fresh expressions, but if that's not there, we look for a demonstrable robustness and maturity, because there's something, the biggest difficulty for pioneers is isolation, both physical isolation, you may be starting something from nothing or just with a few others, but also a bit like Sean, none of the other clergy could make head or tail of him. And so there's a significant capacity for loneliness, because you can't talk to your peers. We also look for the desire and capacity to create team. The secular material on entrepreneurs says there are at least two types, ego-driven and social. Social entrepreneurs serve a cause. It's all for others. I do not need to define ego-driven entrepreneurs. And guess which one we want? You know, the last thing we want is little kings in their kingdom making their own world. And so it's this strange combination of innovative, self-motivated people who serve the kingdom and are deeply committed to the church. That's my best description of it. I can easily send you the official document, which has a whole string. Well, it's exactly the headings of the Church of England's national selection criteria for all priests. There's not a back door or a sort of lowering of the bar. And each of them is focused as to how that would look in a pioneer minister. They are interviewed by three experienced members of the pioneer panel. And they have to pass all the criteria. And then the panel meets together and comes to a corporate discernment. So it normally, if the marks are okay out of the interviews, it's okay. But if there's something niggling, we talk about it and pray about it and then advise the bishop. And that's only about, are they a pioneer? Do they have the vocation, character and gifting to be a pioneer minister? They will then, with that decided, go to a routine national selection conference, which advises the bishop whether this pioneer should be an ordained pioneer or not. Well, we don't find that the criteria clash, because I act as an officer of the ministry division. I did the redrafting. We if I'm honest, wrote this on the back of an envelope because we had a queue. And what we wrote, and I'm a former theological college principal, so actually what we wrote on the back of an envelope was sound stuff. But we had to write it very quickly because we had a whole queue of young adults, much younger than our typical ordinands, with track records of innovative missions, saying, we could never have imagined ourselves as parish priests, but if our church wants us to do this, but patience is not the greatest mark of some of these folks. So we said, well, it'll take us 2 years to write the stuff. We'd have not got there. And then after 5 years' experience of it, we rewrote it and took a lot of advice, other parts of the world, church army, CMS. And then I drafted it with the Chief National Selection Secretary of the Church of England against the same headings. So it's coherent. It's getting the church to imagine deployment that is the issue. See, we deploy to maintain what we've got. We don't really deploy to the mission field or deploy on the basis of God has given us gifts. Where do we best put them? So we find it easier to create curacies for them. Post-curacy stipendiary roles, that's still quite a struggle in some dioceses, but it's about how we deploy resources rather than about whether the criteria actually clash. Yes, it has. One of the evidence for us that we might for once have been hearing God was that about three things happened simultaneously. In fact, four. We were writing Mission Shaped Church. Another whole committee, I mean, stuffed with lawyers, some with glog collars and some not, but stuffed with lawyers, was rewriting something called the Pastoral Measure, which is our Archdeacon's Bible about how you can and can't be church in the Church of England, and recognizing the need to create a whole new, if you like, legislative base for what were then to be called Fresh Expressions. I mentioned in the talk... I mentioned here, ordination services to all three orders were being revised to bring mission more to the fore. And fourthly, the ordination selection criteria were being revised anyway to bring capacity for leadership in mission to a clearly defined essential requirement rather than something that was implicit. And now you cannot now be recommended for training for ordination in the Church of England without demonstrating that with a broad understanding of scope of what you can mean by mission, you have some capacity to be a leader in it. So that helped. It's interesting that anyone selected for training for mainstream parish ministry who it is believed has the capacity to be an incumbent, be a rector for oversight, is expected to have a capacity for pioneering mission, small p. So what we're not doing, and I have to say this quite often still in the Church of England, is corralling all the pioneers into a sort of separate order. But to look, we need imaginative missional leaders in the whole church, but because there are now great sectors of our population that the whole church just does not engage with the church, we need people who can the whole focus of their ministry, as far as it can be seen ahead, is to go and plant the new rather than try and turn around the existing.
I know we grapple with a number of streams, needs for alternative rather than putting everybody through
There are some pretty clear implications. One of the jobs I've got to do by the end of March, as the Church of England moves to for most of its training for ordination, to a platform of awards all accredited by the same university rather than the very diverse way we've been doing, is to write learning outcomes for pioneers at the stage of selection, at the stage of completing ordination training, at the stage of completing a first apprenticeship type post. And of course, if you start from learning outcomes, you then have got to ask, what's the teaching, what's the methodology for the formation and the learning? The House of Bishops' recommendation for the training of pioneer ministers is that it must be an action learning training, in which preferably 50% of the time is spent in relevant supervised experience, and that the learning from that experience is brought, as it were, to the tradition as it's taught, and the formation and the training becomes, if you like, an interactive dialogue between the tradition in which you are being taught and the practices of ministry you're being taught and that experience. And talking to a tutor in one seminary where they were running what they called this mixed mode method, he said, you know, I teach systematics. And he says that when the mixed mode students are in, the level of engagement with the material is entirely different than when the full-time academic residential students are in. So I've been the principal of a theological college in Cambridge, but I would put a bigger measure of action reflection into all training for ministry now. I just don't see how 3 years excellent academic training with a bit of a placement actually equips you for the job. I also think some things we try and teach in seminary you can't learn till you're doing the job. My biggest mistake for about the first year as a seminary principal was I'd come from a parish and I knew what these guys needed to know, so I told them. Trouble was, they didn't know they needed to know it, and it was actually too early, and I had to revise that. So, but there's we did recommend in the report that an understanding of the mixed economy must go into all ministerial training, because we want those who are never called to plant a fresh expression to understand and be approving of those who are. We want those who are never, as far as they know, called to be a traditional parish priest to understand and bless the deep significance of our territorial parish ministry, which we're not going to walk away from for a minute. So. There is only one course that doesn't do the two together, which is a new one that was for lay pioneers that the Church Mission Society are now running, and which we think is the best thing we've got for, excuse the technical theological jargon, but the edgier pioneers, the ones most capable of doing something far away from existing church, deeply authentically Christian. Some of our mixed mode seminary courses are too tame, if I'm honest, for them. But even that course is linked in a regional training partnership with Cudston and with other places. So none of it is totally disconnected. Biggest concentration of pioneers is Ridley Hall and St. Mellitus. Ridley Hall is mainly doing mainstream training, but has got a specialist pioneer tutor. and St. Miletus, which is the Diocese of Chelmsford and London, Holy Trinity, Brompton, and some others all together. Every student does mixed mode. they have substantial placement and times when they come in and so on. So it's mixed mode for traditional parish ministry and it's mixed mode for pioneer ministry, and that gives them lots of links. I mean, there are individual programs that people choose to take. Because of this sense that you went to college, you passed the exams, and you emerged fully formed, as it were, they might send you on a first incumbents course or something like that, but that was it. Bishops you saw when you needed them, if necessary, or supervisors and things like that. The pre-email as well. It took us some. Now, all Anglican, all Church of England clergy are now contracted on the basis of something called common tenure, which requires a process of annual review. It can be done as peer review, but it does mean every year there's a how have I developed, what last year was I saying would be my priorities, what's changed. It's intended to be supportive. Now, I have to admit, lurking behind it is that for the first time ever, we can end a ministry for incompetence. I've never been able to do that before. We've been able to end a ministry for theft, sexual abuse, all sorts of other things. But if someone just doesn't do the job, particularly the old days, they had something called freehold. They were there until they reached the legal retirement age. If they were taking the services and absolutely nothing else, there's really nothing. We had no power to stop it. But the fact that safeguard for a parish, because that's why it's important, is now possible, is not the reason. It would be a sledgehammer to crack a nut to have evaluation for that. The idea is to help people every reflect on ministry with someone who's a peer but who's been trained to do it, and then in our system it goes to the bishop. Not for the bishop to jump up and down and howl or something like that, but so, and then there'll be a letter just affirming all that's good, strengthening the underlying any recommendations and so on. So I don't want it to sound more than it really is. I mean talk to Jackie, she finds her annual meeting with her person really helpful, but it is new to us. It was not Church of England until a little while ago. And frankly, we're catching up with better practice in the secular world. But please.
What kind of training do you do for those who are actually doing that kind of interview?
Okay. I think it is... I mean, my straight answer to your question is I don't know because I've never been trained in it, but I know that what happens is our diocese takes, or that the director of training is for the diocese is very skilled in that, and he has a program for those people before they do what they do, and all of the trainers gather once a year to reflect together on whether they need to train the system, change the system, and so on. Canterbury is about 200 clergy, so you can't ask people to do more than a few of these a year, and therefore you need actually quite a lot of it. Lay people as well as ordained people, retired as well as current. What I do think we have to be careful about our roles. I mean, we have a disciplinary procedure in which if there is serious misconduct, it is the bishop who will make a decision about whether someone comes out of ministry or not. And it is a transparent process, and there is a right of appeal. And if you don't like what the bishop says, you can try a tribunal. Even that has slightly changed the relationship between bishop and people. Difficult for us to be pastors and judges at the same time. So in my view, people act on behalf of the bishop to do review, rather than the bishop's officers are doing the review as it were the bishop's spy. We need trusting relationships with our folk. So I'm uncomfortable about senior officers actually doing it. Except in certain circumstances where they're knowledgeable about very complicated situations and they have more chance of doing it with empathy than someone else, then I'd do it. And of course, these things come across your desk, you see, something doesn't sound quite right there, and then you can take an initiative for this. Also, if there's 200-300 churches or something like that, how on earth do you stay in touch without some process like that? How are we doing? Yeah. Yeah. Now the problem. The problem is, our dioceses tend to do things in silos. The finance people are doing their job, the training people are doing their job, the mission people are doing their job. And if, I don't know what metaphor you want to use, if you're not all singing off the same hymn sheet, or they're working to the same priorities, or all the ducks aren't in a row, so you can do a huge amount about priorities for mission. But if your board of finance is not prioritizing mission in its budget decisions, it actually doesn't mean very much. We have trouble with the Diocese of Canterbury is we're too near Hastings, where some Normans arrived a long time ago. And they built a lot of church buildings to celebrate their conquest, and we have still got rather a lot of them. So one of the biggest challenges in the Diocese of Canterbury is getting village churches to have decent heating, a toilet, and some simple kitchen. And yet we have a board that where you have to go to, all legal, about what you can do to change a church building. And very often heritage rather than mission is their biggest concern. So bizarrely, if you've not got some mission-minded people on those who decide what you can do with your buildings, what you do with your money, I mean, we all wish we were the Diocese of Exeter, who had a newer person appointed to its board of finance, who went to chair the board of finance, went to the bishop and said, "Bishop, this diocese has been putting money away for a long time in case of a rainy day. I think I feel a few raindrops." And released £1 million for a mission opportunity fund. The Diocese of Sutherland Nottingham has just said to every deanery, as you plan now, because they sort of, they deploy some of the decision making, 1/10 of everything must be for new mission. And when the deaneries pretended they hadn't heard it, they went back, asked the bishops, and said, "We weren't joking. You didn't hear wrong. 1/10 of everything goes for the new." So it's actually delivering what's helpful. Most of the stuff is not done by people like us. It's done by parish priests and lay teams and so on. But getting the deployment of resources so it's actually behind. The easiest thing in the world for bishops is to declare their priorities. But if you can't line up your resource delivery to time with your priorities, it doesn't mean too much. Yeah. Oh, yep. Barry. Yep. No, and that's more than my clock here says. So I'm. Thank you for the blessing, Jenny. Please, yeah.
Structures
I won't talk as long, and we'll talk together more in the last one in this series. But I do want to say a little bit about the difference between an institution and a movement. So I'll come back to that one. It was Niebuhr, I think, wrote something about the characteristics of the two that I've found quite helpful. So we. Dioceses and districts and regional associations and all synods and all the other things that we've got need increasingly to be movements that are administered well rather than institutions that have firmly established how things are done. There's nothing in there about not being competent about the handling of finances or transparent about appointments and review and so on. That's just being properly professional. But I don't think the world is ever going to stay still again. I think state change is the new status quo, and I'll make a couple of suggestions this afternoon about where we need to prioritize so that we can be more adaptable than we are. So I think I've said I'll answer that this afternoon, but please. Yes. I think there's two groups in there. There are people, good people, often very good people, who have been largely older people now in my context, who have always come to church because what you do. I mean, we're British, after all, or whatever it may be. And you've got to be very careful that you don't tell them what they've invested a large part of their life in actually was empty and meaningless and hollow. It's nurturing the flame on. I think there's a variety of ways to do that. In Canterbury Diocese, Casio's been very helpful for lots of middle church or liberal Catholic parishes to bring that. And sometimes I think Casiistas are more fanatical than people have done Alpha, and you have to be a little bit careful how they sell it. But if there's a gentleness in it, it can renovate a community from the heart without any feeling of having been told off for being wrong so far. If you're parish is going to introduce some sort of introductory course, whatever one you choose, allegedly for those from outside, get people used to it by doing the regular congregation to do it first. Actually found that if there's a concern about children, sometimes a new service that people can bring their children or grandchildren to has remarkable capacity to teach them truths they should have known a long time ago. But the penny has crossed. I think you can be. There's wise ways that do. Above all, it mustn't seem targeted at them, but rather an opportunity for them to take. We have found when Bishop of Gloucester, did his sabbatical about worship in Fresh Expressions. What he wrote it up and said, actually, what Mission Shaped Church has done, it has made many parishes that wouldn't dream of doing a Fresh Expression understand their missionary calling again. And I think if you can sow those seeds, I think it's engagement in mission awakens discipleship. So sometimes I think it's the mission bit follows and the Christ leads, and the other part follows. I will never forget going as the newly arrived Bishop of Maidstone, living in a village called Charing, as in Charing Cross, on the Pilgrim's Way, and the Women's Institute of our village invited Jackie and I to go and address them. And these are formidable old ladies. You are 80 before you're a mover and shaker. And this barn was full of 60 or 70. And it was all very nice. We told our story and it was sweet. And then from the back came this voice, "Bishop!" And I thought, I'm in trouble. "We worry that none of our grandchildren come to church. Do you think they would come to a church like ours?" Now, Jackie and I had been. The answer was no. We'd just arrived, so we looked at one another and thought, tell the truth, win friends, tell the truth, win friends. We don't really think they would. And there was this long, pregnant pause. "Neither do we. What do you think we could do?" And something awakened. Now, that was a parish where we had to retire the priest early. Not because they weren't paying their way, because he was worn out and it was a kindness. And the new person who came in created a cafe-style all-age gathering that their grandchildren and the children of the local school came to. And it quite began to change the historic congregation. So just a variety of suggestions, really. But it's a really important question. And we're just about on time, I think. Jenny's nodding at the back. So for the next one, because I've sort of fired my stuff at you, and I'll do a little. I will keep myself to 15 minutes intro next time. Would you make sure you've thought of the questions that, above all, you really hoped we would be talking about, and we will run this much more on your agenda than my imported one. But thank you very much.